Today on Maine Calling, big old buildings transformed into new housing. A seminal study last year found that Maine needs about 80,000 new homes by 2030 to keep up with demand. At the same time, many older civic and commercial buildings sit empty around the state. So, could those buildings be part of the solution? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with some of the people involved in converting old mills, schoolhouses, nursing homes, hospitals, and other large buildings into residential housing, especially affordable housing. These buildings often have great locations near shops and services, but they can be tricky and expensive to renovate. How does their approach work, and is it doing anything to alleviate the housing shortage? This program is part of our series, The Cost of Living, Maine's Housing Crisis. That's on Maine Calling, just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downey's communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. All over the state, older or historic buildings offer potential living space to help alleviate Maine's severe lack of affordable housing. Today, we'll hear some examples of how these housing conversions work and what the projects entail. This program is part of our series about Maine's housing crisis, The Cost of Living. Joining me, Kevin Bunker, founder and principal with Developers Collaborative, Tara Kelly, Executive Director of Maine Preservation, and Mark Wiesendonger, Director of Development for Maine Housing. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you thinking about an old building in your community? Have you tried to find housing in one of them? You can send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us. Mark, I'm going to start with you. We've heard this number over and over again because of that big study last year that says Maine is going to need somewhere in the vicinity of 80,000 new housing units by the year 2030 and needs about a quarter of that right now. I'm wondering, as we look around the state, larger, older buildings that could be converted into housing. How much of a dent, in your view, could these kind of buildings put into that problem? I mean, are we talking about 20,000 units more?
Thank you, Jennifer. Yeah, absolutely. The thing is that we have been for years using older buildings, doing adaptive reuse projects to create affordable housing. It's not a new thing for us. There are a lot of buildings out there available. Some municipalities have old schools, for instance, that are available for redevelopment. Sometimes they're a great idea. Sometimes they are not. Not all old buildings, just because something exists doesn't mean it's a good plan. Sometimes it may just be too expensive or not conducive to creating housing. But as you've seen or heard, I'm sure, we have a lot of old mills in Biddeford and Lewiston and other towns that have been recently converted to housing, and it's been very successful. Ultimately, they are a little more expensive to do than a traditional new construction project. So we always have to keep that in mind and find additional resources. But fortunately, we do have things like the historic tax credit to help with that.
Yeah, and I want to dig into that a little bit. But I want to just stay with you for a minute, Mark, and we talk about some of the old mills and things like that that have been converted. Are there sort of you know, your A-plus students? Are there are certain projects, those that you really want to replicate, that you've really been so happy with how they've turned out and what they've meant for their communities that you'd like to talk about right now?
Yeah, well, I just want to say, first of all, that we love all of our developer partners the same. But we have a couple of folks joining us on the call today, Kevin Bunker being one of them, and hopefully Nathan Zanton shortly. They both have had some very great success converting older buildings into affordable housing. I think of Kevin's project at the Macaulay School, the Mother House project. That's an amazing old building, and they turned it into wonderful. In Portland, and they turned it into wonderful housing. Nathan has had great success with Mills in Biddeford and Lewiston, turning them into projects. He's got one, Picker House Lofts, under construction right now, and it's amazing what they've done with these buildings, and while maintaining the kind of historic fabric of these communities. It's pretty rewarding to see somebody move into one of these factories where their Meme and Pepe worked 75 years ago. So we've seen a lot of great success, and these guys can probably tell you a little more about their individual projects.
Well, Kevin, I want to turn to you because I have some buildings in mind, and I'm sure all of our listeners do as well, buildings that they've driven by and said, wow, that would make great apartments, great condos. How do you look at these buildings that might be different than the average person? When you hear about a building that's vacant, when you hear that there are people in the neighborhood or the community who would love to do something meaningful for it, when you drive by and look at a building, what are you looking for?
Well, there's a few things. There's the things that everyone thinks of, you know, location, location, location. We all kind of know that you have to have a building in a place where there's some market. If you're doing a main housing project, it's location, 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 because they have scoring points based on what town you're in. Like, I was driving through Richmond the other day, taking my daughter to camp, and I texted folks at my office saying, this is a great little area. We should do a project here. And they're like, it gets 0 points. We can't do one in Richmond. So there's layers of scoring we have to look at as well. But then there's the things that maybe an average person wouldn't think about when they're driving by a building. And that first thing is windows. You have to have bedrooms have to have windows. So if you have a building that only has a few windows or doesn't have windows in a regular pattern along upper floors, you can pretty much throw out housing on a historic building, because to utilize a historic tax credit, you can't blast a bunch of windows where they weren't previously there. And every bedroom has to have a window. So if you see a nice regular pattern of windows on some second, third, fourth floors, you automatically start, your brain can start thinking about putting some apartments in there.
Okay, so Tara, a lot of people, both Kevin and Mark have mentioned historic tax credits, and I want to back up a little bit and ask you, how does this work? How does a building qualify for a historic tax credit? How much is it worth? Is it a difference maker? So explain the whole process.
Sure thing. So thank you also for having me here today. Maine has a really successful and robust historic rehabilitation tax credit program. It's based off of a federal program that provides 20% of qualified rehabilitation expenditures on historic buildings, and that's of any kind. But to qualify, a building must be listed in the National Register of Historic Places. And I can talk about that eligibility in a second. But then Maine's credits tax on top of that at an additional 25% of those expenses. So combined with the federal, we're talking about 45% credit on your project. And then Maine very uniquely, and this was recently highlighted in a report by the National Trust for Historic Preservation as a model to follow in states across the country, that we have a 10% booster for affordable housing on top of that. So that certainly sweetens the deal, makes projects pencil, providing 55% of project costs for historic buildings converted into affordable housing.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but how long has that been in place? How long has that been the case where you can add it all up to 55%?
So the credit was enacted in Maine in 2008. The booster has kind of adjusted over time slightly, but we have had this program for, going over 16 years now. And it has been tremendously impactful. As Mark noted, we've got a lot of large mill buildings that have gone through this process, a lot of smaller buildings too, and not just housing, obviously, but the focus of today's conversation is that for in terms of eligibility for the National Register, we're typically starting with a building that's over 50 years old. And then there are some requirements around, was it designed by a significant architect? Did something important in history happen there? Is it reflective of a certain type of history that's local to a given community? So that's where we get, that, as Mark said, the Meme and the Pepe working in the mill in that community, it's really rich part of that history. That's what can qualify it for the National Register. And you're looking also for a certain amount of intactness or integrity, that the building is recognizable for that history, that you can sort of still see those elements. And when Kevin mentioned the kind of there are rules associated with this, right? That if you're taking advantage of a historic tax credit, the ancillary benefits are tremendous, but of course we have to follow some guidelines that say what you can and can't change with regard to the historic fabric. So in many cases, yes, you cannot necessarily punch a new window in. However, if the facade where the windows are needed for that housing is sort of in a minimally visible or not visible to the public way, then you can add those new windows. So it's project by project, case by case.
All right, Mark, I want to circle back with you and ask about this historic tax credit and what kind of difference it's made. I just remember 20 years ago driving around Maine and seeing all these beautiful old mill buildings, but being told by developers and government officials, oh, it is just prohibitively expensive. They'll never be redeveloped. So it seems as though it has just been a sea change in the last 15 years or so.
Yeah, it really has, and that is due to the historic credit. The work that we do in affordable housing, especially through the low-income housing tax credit program, our projects are expensive by nature. They are very well built. They have to meet very high standards, whether it's accessibility or energy efficiency standards. They are very well built, and they have to be able to operate for a very long time, and they have to be durable. So you add in this other factor of the historic aspect of a building and trying to maintain and keep that in place, and these projects are get even more expensive. But because of that additional credit, we've been able to leverage historic and low-income housing tax credits and paying loans and various subsidies and oftentimes a community will chip in with a TIF, or they will give the building away for free, or they will find some CDBG funds to put into the project. So these projects
Community
end up
Development
having,
Block Grant Funds. Okay, go on.
yes,
Yeah,
sorry,
that's okay.
I will use a lot of acronyms here, as we all will.
No, you won't.
I'll
But
try
no,
to
that's
avoid.
good. Well, we'll go, Kevin, I want to talk to you though about, despite the tax credits, we all know anybody who's done any kind of project on their own house, any town that's trying to build a new school, we all know what's happened to housing construction costs in recent years. Even with these tax credits, is it becoming more and more difficult to make these projects worth it financially?
Yeah, it absolutely is. You can generally assume that you can make the numbers work. The problem is if you Mark made a good point that the units Maine Housing builds are generally more expensive than regular units, but they also have caps to make sure they don't get too expensive. So sometimes you can layer all the pieces together in this amazing capital stack wedding cake to make the deal work, and then it goes over the cost cap. So you have to be very careful of that as well. And just the cost of construct, the person on the street might think that because you have a historic building, you already have half a building and you only have to put half a building in it. But really, most times you're basically putting a brand new building inside a historic brick shell, and it ends up being a little more expensive. But since just going to new construction for a minute, we spend $300 a foot now for what we spent $130 a foot for 10 years ago, and it's
Wow.
the same building. So that dynamic just makes things incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Yeah, so I'll throw this question to you, Tara. why, given the cost, why do this? Why build a brand new building inside of the shell of an old building instead of just starting over again?
Well, obviously, I'm biased as a preservationist by training and profession, but I think that, you know, I think we all in Maine really recognize the importance of our historic neighborhoods and downtowns and communities. And while, of course, new construction becomes another layer to that in our sort of future history, taking advantage of what we have here and really, you know, finding new uses for our older buildings is something that makes it a much richer place to be. And, you know, I also think that, and, you know, I hope that Kevin agrees that the historic buildings and older buildings in our communities are also incredibly well built. They have a human scale. They just have interesting quirks that make them more kind of exciting to be in. And there's also a sustainability factor to this that I think is can't be ignored, that throwing a building away is also expensive, and throwing a building away is incredibly wasteful. And so even if there is an expense associated and that there is a lot of effort that needs to go into building inside of that shell, we are also kind of it's like the biggest form of recycling that we can possibly undertake. And I think that that's incredibly important factor.
Go ahead, Mark. I would agree that
Go ahead, Kevin.
I would agree they're super well built. We're doing one right now. It's actually in the Press Herald this morning. It's not affordable housing. It's market rate housing, but it's an old auto dealership on Forest Ave, 509 Forest. And the thing is built rock solid. It's the first auto mile in Portland. It's in 1928. Later on, it became a nightclub. And we had Frank Sinatra in there, Ella Fitzgerald in there, Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington. And we're putting historic lofts in there. So to Tara's point, if I'm trying to rent a loft apartment to somebody, I'm going to have a lot better time renting it to someone if it used to be an auto dealership 100 years ago and Frank Sinatra sang there once, than if it's just a three-story random box. You know, and that's not just because it's sexy, it's because there's a sense of place to it that wouldn't exist otherwise.
And Mark, what did you want to add?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, especially in the affordable world, we often receive a little pushback from the community in which we want to build affordable housing. It's not always, some towns are more welcoming than others, of course, but if you can take a building that is sitting there and, you know, potentially going to fall apart, and it's been there everybody's whole lives and it's a part of the community, they're going to embrace that project a lot easier than a new construction box down the street that wasn't there before.
Well, we are talking about converting old historic buildings into multi-unit housing, especially affordable housing, but adding to the much needed housing stock in Maine. What are your thoughts on this? You can call 1-800-399-3566, send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, converting older buildings into affordable housing units. What are the challenges and success stories? With me, Tara Kelly, who is Executive Director of Maine Preservation. Mark Wiesendonger, he is Director of Development for Maine Housing, and Kevin Bunker, who founded Developers Collaborative. Share your comments and questions. Are there any buildings you'd like to see turned into affordable housing or just housing? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line now, Nathan Zantin, who is founder and president of Zantin Company. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You already probably had your ears burning. You've been mentioned on the program by Mark. But I know that you've done some interesting projects. Tell us about the one that's going on right now, Uptown in Bath.
Sure. That was interesting because for a couple of reasons. One is I heard Kevin mention location. The location of that one is perhaps my favorite location of all the ones we've ever done. It's right in the middle of downtown Bath, across from their beautiful 1887 library, and across from the park, Library Park, right next to the library. It's on the site of a former YMCA gym and pool that was torn down in about 2012. And we built a ground-up building on that site and then connected it to two historic buildings that are adjacent to it that face Front Street, which is Bath's major shopping street. Those are at the corner of Summer Street and Front. They were designed by noted architect John Calvin Stevens. They needed a lot of work. One of them had 10 apartments in it that were in bad shape. We renovated those. And then the other one, which had been a theater, had no housing in it, and we put four duplex apartments into that. So 10 plus the 4 plus 46 that we built on the old gym and pool totaled 60 units, and it's right walkable to everything in downtown Bath. So it was a combination of ground-up construction, historic, adaptive reuse of historic buildings, and then also acquisition and rehab of existing housing. So it was a complicated project.
But it's open now?
It's open now. Yep. In fact, all but four of the apartments are filled.
Well, congratulations. Tell us about another big project of yours, Picker House Lofts. This is one in Lewiston.
Sure. So this one is under construction now. It's going to open its doors in February of 2025. It's in an enormous mill complex called the Continental Mill, which is right on the banks of the Androscoggin River along Cedar Street, Cedar Street is the street that leads to Little Auburn. And it's a 550,000 square foot mill complex, which is absolutely enormous. And we couldn't handle that much space, but we approached the owner, which is a company out of New Hampshire called Chinberg Properties, and asked them if we could buy part of it. And we worked out a deal to buy 15% of it, which is about 85,000 square feet. And we're doing 72 apartments, mixed income apartments, some low income and some market rate, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. I want to circle back to something we were talking about earlier on the program, which is the role of historic tax credits. How important are they to you in the projects you do? And is their role changing?
Oh, they're a sine qua non, as lawyers say, without which nothing. We couldn't do these projects without the historic tax credits, both the federal and the state. If either one of those went away, the projects would be financially infeasible. I heard Tara kind of doing a rundown on the numbers. And so, as she said, 55% of the eligible costs that are considered part of the historic rehab can come back to us in the form of tax credits when we're doing affordable housing. And then we can sell those credits to investors who will give us roughly 80 cents on the dollar. So we get 4/5 of that amount of money back as capital to build the building. And that's just so critical because it's capital to build the building that doesn't have to be repaid. So it displaces debt. It makes your mortgage much smaller. And that means you can afford to rent at much lower prices.
All right. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for calling in and being part of the conversation. Nathan Santon with the Santon Company. I really appreciate it. And good luck with your projects. I'm going to go to some of what's coming in from our audience here. I'm going to start with this email from Carl. What about converting some of the very limited use shopping malls, like the Auburn Mall, which is nearly vacant? It is on a public bus line and a supermarket is next door. So it's interesting because we've been talking about historic tax credits, historic buildings, mills and schoolhouses. I think a lot of people are thinking of images of red brick and things like that. But boy, shopping malls, many of them have seen their heyday and are either vacant or near vacant. Mark, do you see potential in these?
Absolutely. I mean, I see a potential in any kind of building. I believe this has been done in other places, certainly. And as we move back to the kind of the main street model versus the mall that's set out out of town, I think it may be something that really works. That said, not every building is conducive to housing. It may be that it's just not cut up and laid out in a fashion that makes sense for that type of use, or that it's just, you know, past its useful life because of the way it was built in the first place. That said, it's a lot of space, and who knows, maybe we could turn it into housing. Just got to find the right developer and the right architect to do it.
Kevin, you're a creative guy. What would you say to a shopping mall? We're trying to unmute, I think. Okay, so anyway, we'll come back to that. I'll ask you, Kevin, what you think of a shopping mall. In the meantime, I'm going to go to this email from Maria Libby, who is superintendent of MSAD in Camden. She says, our district is working hard to convert a late 1800s building that is on the National Register into 8 teacher apartments, but I am finding it extremely difficult to find the funding to do so. We cannot access historic tax credits. It does not qualify as affordable housing, and we want to retain ownership of building and land. We are trying to be innovative, but we don't seem to have access to funds that would otherwise be available to help us. Do you have any ideas for funding sources that might be available to us? Tara, any ideas for Maria?
I think that, you know, there are a lot of components to this that are valuable to understand in terms of the details, like who is the owner of the building. Like, tax credits are harder to use, for example, if you're a nonprofit. So I don't know if that is the we that is being discussed. It can be done, but it's more challenging. In the case of a nonprofit, there is some grant funding available. If it's municipal owned or nonprofit owned, you might be able to access congressionally directed spending. So there are a number of questions involved as to kind of the details of the project that make me want to answer differently. But I'm happy to have any of my colleagues weigh in with their ideas.
And also, I'm wondering, will Maine Preservation work with, I mean, it sounds like this is the school district and a historic building if it's on the National Register. Can you all work as partners to help figure this out?
Absolutely. We are available to answer anybody's questions, whether they're a private homeowner or a municipal government or anything in between. So feel free to reach out to us. Our website is mainepreservation.org, and there you can find our phone number and email address.
All right. And Maria wants to add, this building is the Elm Street School in downtown Camden. Before we go back to the shopping mall question, Kevin or Mark, either of you have any ideas for Maria Libby, the superintendent in Camden?
I'm happy to speak with Maria about her project. There might be an opportunity with one of our programs. It's called the Rural Affordable Rental Housing Program, which allows for incomes up to 80% of area median income. I am married to a teacher, so I have an idea of what their incomes are, and often they qualify for affordable housing. But we're happy to talk about it. One thing that does become a problem when we want to build housing for a specific group, we may run into fair housing issues. So we have to be careful about that, but usually we can find ways to make it work.
All right, Kevin, I'm going to circle back to the shopping mall question. Our emailer, Carl, has got his eye on the Auburn Mall. What would you say to Carl?
So I would say to Carl that there may be housing opportunities at the Auburn Mall. They're probably not in the Auburn Mall. Again, going back to what a little bit about building science and how it's evolved over time. And we used to build buildings very, very well. Then starting in around 1960, we said, to hell with it, and started building them terribly and cheaply through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And a lot of those buildings that were built that we come across now, there's not a lot of value left in them, and we would tear them down. But the other thing with, I mentioned windows earlier. If you're looking to convert a building to housing, you're looking not only for windows, but you're also looking for the building width, because again, you have to get, people need light and air. So if you're going to do an efficient building that's going to be able to compete in the market, you usually want a double loaded corridor, which means a corridor with units on both sides of it, because you don't want to build too much common space that you have to heat and construct, but you can't rent. So if your building is too wide to not allow you to do a double loaded corridor, it's really hard to do residential. So that's why a lot of malls, big blocky square spaces, don't make good residential conversions. And that's actually, if you read some of the articles, there's what's hot in the streets now is converting offices to residential. That's the everyone's on everyone's lips because of the decline in offices. Office floor plates are often big blocky squares because they'll throw people in cubicles and don't give them windows. Can't do that in residential. So that said, a lot of malls were built with parking lots that were designed for Black Friday shopping. And people are understanding now that having mixed uses going on, having residential at the same place as interesting shopping experiences is a good thing. So I think repurposing malls is more about understanding the changes in retail, understanding which tenants are gone and aren't coming back, understanding which sort of entertainment type uses could come in and fill those big spaces that then residences are going to want to be near. So I think there's a key to it, but it's not as simple as putting apartments in the malls.
Thank you. Calling in now is Amanda Bartlett, who is Chief Operating Officer now for Developers Collaborative, but before that, Director of the Augusta Housing Authority. Thanks for calling in, Amanda. And I want you to tell us about the middle school in Augusta that got transformed into housing for older residents.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So some time ago, I think that project was completed in 2016. During my time at the Housing Authority, we were able to complete the conversion of the former Hodgkins Middle School in Augusta into 47 units of senior housing. And I did that actually using Kevin as my development consultant at the time. And this was, a historic property that was originally constructed in 1958.
And how was that 1958, that era, a good thing or a bad thing when you were doing the project?
I wouldn't say it was a good thing or a bad thing. I would say it was an interesting thing. It was kind of one of the first school conversions from that era happening around that time here in Maine and probably nationally as, buildings become eligible after 50 years. And the cool thing about the building was that, the mid-century modern design of schools from the 50s, although not particularly aesthetically pleasing, they're kind of like these big bomb shelters of a building without much in the way of features, but they really lend themselves very well to an easy conversion to housing with, the corridors and classrooms that can be easily split up into apartments.
Okay, so I'm wondering, so many towns are in a position where they're trying to rebuild schools and will have empty schools on their hands. What is your advice for anybody else who's approaching an older school for a conversion?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is obviously looking at the physical suitability for a housing conversion. So, making sure you have the square footage needed to, you kind of have to have a certain critical mass of units for some funding sources, particularly if you're looking at the low-income housing tax credit. Mark mentioned earlier the availability of their rural housing program, which can certainly help with maybe some smaller projects when paired with the state and federal historic tax credit. But that's kind of the first thing. One thing that works really well with these older schools is that, now we're kind of seeing this movement in communities to consolidate schools all onto one campus. But historically, neighborhood schools were the way to go. And so you see in a community like Augusta, where historically there were seven small schools spread across the community and nestled into these nice little residential neighborhoods, that works really well for a housing conversion and certainly for eligibility with the low-income housing tax credit, which is scored competitively and with points given to sites that are walkable and close to services and schools and so forth. So, that's one thing. The other factor is that for towns and school districts that are looking to offload schools that they're no longer using, there is an opportunity if you can give away a property at low or no acquisition cost, it certainly makes a project more financially feasible. And that's what we did in Augusta. The city was originally slated to spend, I think, at least a couple $100,000 on demolition costs for that project. But, we came in and offered to redevelop redevelop the property, and in exchange for them giving us a long-term lease for a dollar. So we were able to save the taxpayer dollars in terms of demo costs to the city, but also preserve the building for the long-term and create housing.
Great. And before we let you go, I understand there's an effort now to build more housing adjoining the project we've been talking about.
Yes. So we are excited to recently receive notification that funding has been received to build out that second phase of housing, which will be new construction behind the Hodgkin School. That will also be senior housing, but not a historic project.
Well, Amanda, thanks for calling in. Amanda Bartlett used to be with the Augusta Housing Authority and now works for Developers Collaborative. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're learning about one of the ways that people are creating affordable housing and more housing is by using older or historic buildings and putting them to new use. My guest today, Mark Wiesendonger with Maine Housing, Kevin Bunker with Developers Collaborative, and Tara Kelly with Maine Preservation. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We have an email here from Pat. Pat writes, Mahoney Middle School in South Portland is a great candidate for condos or apartments. Some buildings offer in-house fitness centers, and the gymnasium has an old elevated running track that is a really cool feature that you don't see anymore. So I'm familiar with Mahoney Middle School, beautiful red brick building. Who wants to talk about Pat's idea that that would be a great candidate?
I'll step in quickly. I can actually see Mahoney from where I'm sitting right now in South Portland. It is a beautiful building. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it's one of the prettiest buildings in downtown South Portland, in this part of South Portland. I caution people in that some buildings are not meant for housing. We've discussed that already. We have had an example in the past of a school that the community was very excited about, gave to a developer, they built housing there, and it has been a financial nightmare for 20 years. That's not to say Mahoney would be the same situation. It really depends on how things are laid out inside. But keep in mind that when these schools were built 100 years ago out of brick and using coal-fired furnaces, things were a lot different. And there often are some very large spaces that you can't put housing in that still need to be heated and maintained over time. And that can add too much cost to a project. There are some creative solutions, and certainly we've seen it in some of our projects in the past, and we have had many successful school redevelopment projects.
All right, Tara, tell us about some of them.
Yeah, thank you. Not so much doom and gloom from me. We have seen great projects in Hollowell, the central building of the Maine Industrial School for Girls, created 29 affordable senior units. The Mildred M. Fox School in South Paris became 12 senior affordable housing units. That was done by Avesta. And then another project by Nathan Zanton in Bath is the John E. L. Hughes School Apartments with 59 affordable housing units. I think among the different building types that we have talked about, schools do have some good building stock for being converted.
All right. We have an email here from Les and Alna. The underlying problem is that we can't afford to build the number of units we need. The projected annual cost around $1.5 billion per square foot cost for new housing today is about $300 per square foot. Only if the cost of renovation of existing structures can be kept under 150 square foot, then can it have a positive impact. Mark, what about those numbers that Les is giving us? We have actually used that number. I think Kevin used that number before, $300 a square foot. At that cost, can Maine catch up? Can we make it to those 80,000 units by 2030?
We're trying to do it. We've had a lot of support recently from the state, from the governor's office, from the legislature, both sides of the aisle. For the first time, we are receiving direct appropriations to fund housing and can expand our programs. We're producing more units than ever. we have a long ways to go. We could use more funding. We could use more developers. We could certainly use a decrease in cost of construction if that could ever happen. We need more subs in the construction industry to come up here and work with us. But we remain hopeful. Everybody seems to be on board with the fact that we need more housing for all income levels. We just don't have enough stock in Maine.
And Kevin, I want to add to you about that. Is the tricky part, as they say, finding enough people to work on these projects, qualified people to work on the projects.
That's a big piece of it. And, you know, with all due respect to Maine Housing, they can't, and they've stepped up huge. They've taken this challenge seriously, and they're 2X, 3X historically what they've always done. But their typical project is 30, 40, 50 units, or some of their programs, it's 10, 20 units. And we're not going to get to 80,000, 30 at a time. The way to solve the housing crisis is it has to happen outside of specialized government programs that are kind of hard to navigate, and frankly, fewer developers want to do them. So really, you have to look at larger macro factors, and there are things we don't control, like interest rates, really ever. There's things that we control in the medium term, which is the workforce. So we need to get people in the trades, help them understand that you can do really well being an electrician, maybe even better than being a developer sometimes, it looks like. But then what we need to do in the short term is get our zoning and land use and our community attitudes right toward housing. You know, the biggest market for housing in the state is in the city of Portland. Portland has a lot of good people in it and does a lot of stuff right, but they also shoot themselves in the foot a lot. They vote in a lot of things that make it very, very difficult to build housing. And, you know, we should be doing hundreds and hundreds of units in Portland, and it's very difficult. We still get a fair amount of housing done. That allows some people to say, oh, look at all the housing in Portland. But if you look at all the housing in Westbrook, South Portland, Scarborough, look at Scarborough Downs. You know, there's some very talented, experienced developers with lots of capital who want to build projects at scale. And in Portland, you really have to build affordable housing or luxury condos because of some of the rules that are in place. So we need to get that stuff right if we're going to talk about a number like 80,000. You know, we can crank out our few hundred units a year. We'll do a great job. We'll cut ribbons. It'll be good. But to really solve that housing crisis in our biggest, best markets, we have to get the policies right.
Tara?
Sure. I just wanted to add on a couple of things. One, the historic trades is like a whole nother series for Maine Calling, and I'd be happy to participate in that. The need for skilled craftspeople in this state and across the Northeast and across the country, frankly. But I also wanted to add that certainly to meet this 80,000 number, we are talking about big projects to scale. But I don't want your listeners to think that they don't have a role to play in this as individuals, and that there are opportunities in creating accessory dwelling units within older homes that have, you know, an L in the back that maybe is too much space for grandma or whomever else, and garages, carriage barns, that are existing buildings that can be converted into housing. And we do have a proposal for creating a historic homeowner tax credit so that there is an incentive for doing just that, and also other vacant buildings. One of our honor awards this year is a former power station in Norridge Walk that has been turned into a home. So there are there is an individual act that can help us to nibble away at that big number.
We'll go to David, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Dave Pelton. I'm the Director of Real Estate Development for KV Cap in Waterville. And I think I love the conversation today because I love old buildings. We recently renovated and turned into affordable housing the old women's prison in Skowhegan. One of the buildings there is now 16 units of housing in that building, and another 24 in a new building right next door to it. I think the main thing that I would like to add to this conversation is how important it is for local buy-in. You know, every community has a elected officials, a city council or selectmen, and getting their buy-in is so important. It is a key factor that it's $300 a square foot is a real number, but that number is only going up. And I know that's an eye-popping number for some people, but I've worked in other states where that number is easily twice that. And so, you know, it seems even more eye-popping when you think about delaying these practices and delaying this building down the road. If we kick the can down the road, it just becomes even more expensive.
David, thank you for calling with your perspective. Do any members of our panel have thoughts on what he said?
I just would want to add that since he's calling in from Waterville, that another great project there is the Mount Marcy Convent, which is a mid-century convent. So a building from the 60s, which we don't have a lot of in Maine, that, you know, is not always well built, has taken advantage of this incentive and created 28 independent apartment units by the Waterville Housing Authority.
Great. And David, since you're calling from Waterville and because of your role, I'm going to pose a question that's come into us on Facebook. George writes, just about the perfect housing building, condos or apartments, is the Seton unit, part of the old hospital in Waterville. This was purchased and approved for development, but I'm not sure it ever occurred. The vision was for higher price units, but that idea may have failed. Does anyone know if this building is being converted for available for public usage? David, do you know the answer to George's question?
I do know that building very well. We looked at that building several years ago. I think Mark pointed out that not every old building is a viable building to convert into housing. We've looked at old schools. We've looked at lots of old buildings over the years. That one in particular has, I think, both potential and challenges, whether or not it's ever turned into housing. Sometimes an old building should probably be torn down and start over. Or in the case of that building, maybe offices would be a better use than housing. That's just my opinion. Having looked at it, maybe Mark or some others have a different opinion.
Well, I did see Mark nodding when you were talking. Mark, you think maybe that'd be a good candidate for offices?
Yeah, I'm sure it can be used for something. It's probably not best used as affordable housing. We've seen a few people come up with some ideas about how to do so, and it just hasn't come to fruition yet. But it is a nice building, and it does have some historic aspects of it that are very interesting. And I'm sure there's another use for it.
David, thanks for your call. We'll try to squeeze in another call. We'll go to Maggie calling from York Beach. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, when these developers build these buildings, do they not go into towns and ask like town members or people who live in the community to help them do this by investing in it? In other words, the state can only do so much. And, you know, I hear about location, 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 and we're talking about affordable housing, but somebody's going to pay more where Frank Sinatra lived.
Right.
I'd like to donate.
Maggie, I'm going to cut you off just because we're almost out of time. Kevin, do you ever go into communities and say help?
Well, you know, we don't really do crowdfunding. If you're raising money, you have to be careful with accredited investors. There's all kinds of securities rules and all that. And but Maggie, if you're from York Beach and you're affluent, you want to invest in one of my projects, you can get you my contact info.
but really, and I want to ask, maybe I'll turn to you, Tara. I mean, we heard about the superintendent from Camden who really wants to do something meaningful with the Elm Street School. And we're hearing from Maggie here. If there's a building in your community, is there a way for the town to rally around and raise some money for it?
Absolutely. We see that happening not just when it comes to affordable housing or housing in general, but every year we put out a most endangered list, which kind of recognizes threatened properties and help people to raise funds around those assets. And then we also have our honor awards every year celebrating the success of preservation projects, of which Kevin and Nathan both have won many, but also towns and grassroots efforts. And so really anybody can save a building, anybody can put it to its next best use, and we are happy to help them do that.
Well, I really want to thank all three of you for being on the program today. Such an interesting conversation. Clearly, people care so much. Kevin Bunker, founder and president of Developers Collaborative, Tara Kelly, Executive Director of Maine Preservation, and Mark Wiesendonger, Director of Development with Maine Housing. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandrow, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find any of our past shows and sign up for our free weekly newsletter at mainecalling.org. Again, mainecalling.org. And also, there's a new way for you to share your thoughts with us. You can download the Maine Public Vox Pop app. That's VOXPOP. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.